Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On this week's episode, we are talking bread, homemade bread, the good stuff. Chiming in are Claire Saffitz, our senior food editor here at BA, and our resident baking expert, as well as my brother, Andy Rappaport, who is an avid home baker and has baked nearly 300 loaves of sourdough bread over the last couple of years. Two of them chat about their methods, compare and contrast, and give you some wisdom in case you've ever thought about making your own bread, but have been a little intimidated by it, like me, because it's an undertaking. All right, let's do this thing. Here are Claire and Andy. Claire Saffitz, welcome back to the pod.
Thank you.
And Andy Rappaport. Is this your first podcast?
First podcast.
All right, so we're talking bread today. And Claire, you're sort of like the resident baking expert at the Bon Appetit staff. Is that fair to say?
That would be the reputation. I don't ever feel like I'm an expert on anything in that realm.
You're like proudly walk around with your baked goods, like preening around the kitchen. We've seen you.
But I'm always like, it's not quite right, or this is messed up. But people eat it anyway.
That's like the Jewish mother in you.
Always give the disclaimer.
All right, so we're talking bread and like home-baked, like really nice loaves, like beautiful loaves with yawning, gaping holes and crust and all that good stuff. We did a piece a couple of Februarys ago, Claire, home-baked bread. And the recipe is 4 pages long and takes 3 days. And yes. At that point, I said, like, I'm out. I'm not doing this.
Yeah, I think Andrew Knowlton refused to even read the recipe on proof. He was like, I can't even wrap my head around this. But the mandate actually from you and from Carla, our food director, was like to come up with a recipe that is the best at-home bread you can make. So that is without a starter, which we'll talk about what that means. So this recipe uses active dry yeast, but it uses all the techniques of like artisan bakers who make these beautiful crusty loaves. So it's sort of a country style loaf. Technically, it's sort of like a modified miche, which means like a whole wheat. Miche is usually sourdough. This is leavened by active dry yeast, not starter. But it has really nice flavor, great depth of flavor. It's not that sour because it doesn't have that sourdough starter. But it's for the few people that actually made it, I got very good feedback.
There's like six of them.
Yeah, right. Six people in the whole country. But they loved it. So it's a lot of work, but it's a really fun process. And I think it's worth it if you like bread.
Well, so let's talk about the process because, Andy, you bake bread regularly at home.
I do.
You shared on your Instagram account. What's your handle?
Andy Rappaport 66.
And so it is a process. And like, I know as a home cook, like, I like to cook things quickly, and I like to have my hands on them, whether it's searing a steak or, you know, stir frying vegetables, and then it's on the plate.
Yes, this is the opposite of that.
Yeah, and so Andy, where do you get that patience from, and what the curiosity, like, why do this?
I think it's the perfectionist in me that's like, if there's something wrong, there's no way I'm letting this go until I get it right. And after, what did I say, 280 loaves that I've baked home over the last 3 years.
Although you had to take like a year break.
Yeah. So my building was out without gas for 13 months. And in that time, I'd almost forgotten everything and had to relearn all over again. But yeah, it's one of those things where I was at the She-Wolf Bakery a few years ago. My girlfriend took me out there.
Andrew Tarlow, who owns Diner.
Exactly.
And Marlow and stuff. Yes. in Brooklyn.
And they provide all the breads for those guys. And their master baker, Austin, he said, you know, I've been doing this for 12 years and I learn something new every single day. And I get it. Every single loaf, you look at it and you're like, this is alive. This is from a live starter. This is a living, you know,
Well, all right. So for a novice like me, I've never baked bread. So explain that to me because it's like, oh, it's the same recipe. It's the same oven. It's the same pan. How can there be, where do the differences come from and how do the differences manifest themselves?
Well, there's so many factors you have to consider. So you make your starter.
All right. First
starter was given to me. I was given a tablespoon of it. from my girlfriend. And
where did she get it? This is like the question.
She made it herself, and she never told me how she developed it. But she'd been making bread occasionally every couple weeks or so, usually a whole wheat. And I mean just whole wheat. So I got this starter, started feeding it with bread flour because I'm not crazy about whole wheat.
All right. First question. Claire, sorry.
Yeah.
Claire's the expert here, Andy.
Yeah.
But just if for a layman like me, what is a starter and how do you start a starter?
Okay. So a starter is a mixture of flour and water, usually in equal parts. And it's been inoculated with a whole system of yeast and bacteria, yeast and lactic acid bacteria, that are living in this environment and they are feeding on the flour and metabolizing it. And so when the yeast and bacteria metabolize the flour, they're creating gas, which is what's leavening that bread and making those holes. And the lactic acid bacteria is producing lactic acid, as you would imagine, and that's creating that sour flavor of sourdough.
Can you make your own starter? Because you always often hear about starters being given to a pinch of starter being given from this person.
Yeah.
So if you were to make your own starter, how do you start a starter?
Yeah. So, right. I actually got the starter that I use from SheWolf, which is a great bakery. But I've also made my own. So you can make your own. All you do is literally mix together flour and water. You have to make sure the water is like free of chemicals, so because that can affect and inhibit a lot of the yeast and bacteria. I've made my own. I used a recipe from a master baker named Peter Reinhardt, and that method is unique. It includes some pineapple juice, which sort of like inhibits the growth of harmful bacteria. You essentially mix together flour and water and let it sit on your countertop until you start to see like bubbling activity. Now, there is a whole range of starters where you have young starters, mature starters. And so you need to let that starter you need to continue to feed it. So like a lot of people joke that having a new starter is like having a pet. You have to like go home and like, I would call my roommate and be like, I'm not going to be home in time. You have to feed my starter.
So all right, two questions. How do you feed a starter and when do you know that the starter is ready to be used for bread baking?
Yeah. So to feed a starter, you discard a lot of it. This is a problem that you'll hear like avid bakers is like, I have too much starter because you have to, unless you're a bakery producing like hundreds of loaves a day, you're going to have an excess of starter. So you have to discard most of it. Use a little bit.
I'm so confused. Where does this too much starter come from?
Well, so you have your starter. Maybe you have a cup of it or so. You have to feed it with a proportionately large amount of water and flour. So if you just add a proportionately large amount of flour and water to your starter, you now have like 6 cups of starter. It's like, what are you going to do with 6 cups of starter?
I don't know.
Right. So you got to either give it away or throw it out. And people make like pancakes from it. They find creative ways to use it. But you essentially add more flour and water to the starter so that you have more food for the yeast and bacteria to feed on.
So it's constantly growing.
Constantly.
And it's metabolizing. And so how often do you feed a starter?
Once you have a mature starter, I keep mine in the fridge because I don't bake every day. Mm-hmm. Bakeries like SheWolf will have it just out at room temperature because they're using it every day and they want it to stay active. So this introduces the idea that temperature is very important. So when you chill a starter, it slows down the metabolism of all those yeasts and bacteria. And I want that because I don't want an active starter that I feed every day.
And what about you, Andy?
I keep mine in the fridge in a mason jar, probably a pint mason jar. And I'm baking probably most days. So, a tablespoon comes out and then the next day another tablespoon will come out. Then I will add, another 2 or 3 tablespoons of flour. And I use, I'm sure there's chemicals in it, but I use New York tap water out of the faucet.
Me too.
Because it's so mineral rich.
Yeah.
And then I will leave that on the counter. And if I don't, attend to it, I've come back, later in the day, and it is like lava overflow.
Wow.
Out. It's incredibly active. Mine is right now.
So, but by putting in the fridge, it tempers the growth process.
Yeah. So at that point, I feed once a week, and I take out 2 tablespoons, and I feed about 300 grams of flour, 300 grams of water. And then when I want to bake, I take it out of the fridge and I have to refresh it. So at that point, the yeast and bacteria are really sluggish and they're not really able to do the work of like leavening a whole loaf. So I keep it at room temperature and over the course of about 2 days, I feed it 3 more times and I'm constantly discarding what I don't need and only keeping 2 tablespoons. And so that's creating something that's super, super active. And the way that you know if it's ready to bake with or not, you see a lot of bubbles. You'll see tons of activity. There'll even be like a little bit of a dome. It'll have gained a whole lot of volume.
What does yours smell like when it's ready to rock?
I mean, for lack of a better word, kind of yeasty, but like almost like beer. Like mine's, it has a really, really beautiful, like nutty smell.
Mine gets really apple cidery. And that, for me, at least, that seems to be the most effective when it gets to that, like, sweet but tart kind of,
so
fermented.
You're using your nose to tell you that it's
ready? Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, you can definitely, as Claire said, see it. I mean, it expands.
Yeah.
It gets bubbly.
Have you ever been like, oh, I'm going to a friend's house tonight for dinner, so I need to bring a loaf, but the starter's not totally at optimal ready stage, but I got to bake this bread anyways?
If I'm going to a friend's for dinner that night and I hadn't started it the day before, there's no way I'm bringing a loaf because of the time required.
So
there's so much required for this bread thing.
You have to
Why don't you just go to Shewolf Bakery and buy a loaf?
I do that sometimes. Well, because to prepare for this podcast, we talked about a couple days ago what our plan was, and I was like, I can't bring a loaf because I haven't started enough time in advance.
So what you did bring is this weird blob in a plastic bin with plastic wrap on.
Yeah. So I brought dough that I mixed today. And Adam, just to answer your earlier question, there's one test you can do with starter to make sure it's ready to be added to your dough. And it's called the float test. That's something that I think the baker Chad Robertson pioneered or at least popularized. He's the baker at Tartine.
He's like bread Jesus.
Yes, totally. Yes. Every at-home sourdough baker just like wishes they could make a loaf that looked like a tartine loaf. At least I think that. But so you take a little pinch of starter, maybe about a teaspoon, and you float it. You dump it into a little bowl of water, and if it floats, it means that there's enough gas in there, that there's enough activity that it can leaven your loaf. If it sinks, you got to wait a little longer.
So you're ready to start making your bread. I guess the first question is, how much starter do you need relative to the ingredients you're building your bread around?
Well, I can give an example of this bread, which your listeners can't see, but is sitting here on my left.
Claire, you want to describe that bread, that loaf?
It looks beautiful. Can I point something out at the loaf?
Sure.
So it has, I can see from here across the table.
So it's a round loaf.
Yeah, it's a boule. It has one big slash down one side, and it's developed what bakers call an ear. So you can see sort of like where it was slashed with a tool called a lom. Or did you use a razor?
I just use I have a lom, but I took it out. I took the razor blade out of it because I like to have
just hold it.
The closeness of
it. Looks like a big gaping battle scar across its back.
Yeah.
Like if Godzilla got in a fight.
Oh, yeah.
Right. That's a good thing.
With like Mothra or something.
That's what it is. It's a slash, yeah.
And then you've got some little slashes running perpendicular.
Which I didn't do as deeply as the major slash across it. So which is more decorative, I suppose. The deeper you go, the more it will open up. Because the air is escaping. But if you do smaller ones on the side there, it just it looks like little, I don't know, florets.
But now, in terms of the functional purpose for the slashes?
Yeah. So the bread is going to expand when all the gas that's trapped inside in these pockets heats up in a super hot oven. They expand. And the bread, if you don't give it a place, if you don't slash it, it will expand unpredictably and kind of split haphazardly. So you're really just giving it, you're cutting it so that it has
controlled release.
Yes, exactly. You're controlling how it expands. And so this ear is sort of what, like you see it on tartine loaves where you usually use the lom, which just means blade. In French, it's like a razor blade on a handle. You go in at an angle, and as the loaf bakes and expands, like part of it kind of like opens up and out and creates like a little weird little shelf on the side.
Now, Andy, you also have a bunch of what looked like concentric circles made out of flour. What's going on there?
When I made the dough and was ready to put it into it's called a proofing basket, which is the final stage where you shape the dough. And
Those are those little sort of like, what's that? What's the material?
It's like a wicker or
rattan. Yeah, wicker, it's lined with like
you can have a liner, which, or a linen.
Linen,
which is nice.
Yes.
When you don't use a liner, the bread kind of grows around the concentric circles.
Oh, that's what it's from. So you flour the basket.
You flour the basket.
Oh, because I was like, how did you make those circles so perfect?
Pop the dough in. So when you take it out, you know, I guess where the concave parts would have no flour and the convex parts would have flour in it. So you have this nice, pretty sort of design there. In terms of, to get back to your quick question about timing and, you know, why you can't bring a loaf to a dinner party that someone asked for that day, when you know, I was asked to bring a loaf here, it was 2 days ago. And when we worked on it on Monday.
Okay.
And I knew that I was traveling on Tuesday, and if I got back in time, I could probably start the Levain to make the dough. I'll explain that. And time it right so that I could bake it for this morning. But I wasn't going to get back until yesterday afternoon. So I had my gal go to my house to start it with me. She took some starter out. Mix it with some water and some flour.
And put that on the counter.
Put that on the counter.
So it came to temperature.
Yes. So by the time I got home, it had started fermenting, you know, to the right amount. Yeah. So I could make the dough. I think it was yesterday around 6 o'clock.
Now, when did this come out of the oven? Because it's still fragrant.
That came out of the oven about 2 hours ago.
Wow. And if it's not warm, it would not be fragrant, would it?
You would still be able to smell. I've taken, like, freshly baked loaves that weren't still hot, but, like, on the subway, and, like, the whole train car smells like
right,
it.
Right,
It's like when someone brings McDonald's french fries on the train, you're like, oh, man.
I could write a book about all the weird things, all the weird foods I've taken on the train and, like, made the whole car smell like latkes. That was a good one.
You ever bring Popeye's fried chicken on the train?
I've never had Popeye's fried chicken.
Oh, my God. That's a whole other podcast.
Wow. So I think, you know, the point is that when you know that you have to have a bread ready, you have to start calculating backwards.
Yeah.
Because you know that the baking is going to take this amount of time. The prepping the dough, fermenting it, proofing it is going to take that amount of time. So, you know, plus there's sleep involved and, you know, you don't want to be doing it at, you know, 2 a.m. So, yeah, you have to start thinking backwards. So, as Claire was saying, you know, a bread can take 2 or 3 days, you know, to find
Claire,
final product.
You raised your hand when he said there's sleep involved.
Well, I have a question. Do you do a cold rise or do you cold proof at all?
I do. And I've found that it's easier for a couple of reasons. Number one, you can sleep.
What does that mean?
It means, you know, a lot of times, you know, you'll let it proof on your countertop.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different climates, there's different altitudes. So, you know, Tartine, you know, Chad out in the West Coast, you know, he's baking these breads and proofing them with these circumstances in this environment. So if you don't want to think about that, you can proof it in your refrigerator. And it's a very slower, it's a slower process.
But it's a controlled environment.
It's a controlled environment. And it should, you know, quote unquote, you know, produce the same results every time. Now, of course, you know, there's a lot of other factors involved, like, you know, how is your starter doing this week compared to 2 weeks ago? You know, how long was your dough, you know, at the fermenting stage before you proofed it in the refrigerator? The other good thing about refrigerator proofing is that the next day when you take it out, it's got a solidity to it. So when you're slashing it with your razor blade, it's almost like a tougher skin.
Yeah, that's so it's easier.
But if it's a gooey, you know, meltier, humid, hot day and you leave it on your counter, you can, you know, almost not even slash it sometimes.
All right, we're now going to take a quick break for a word from one of our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So I have a lot of nerdy questions about the bread that you bake. Like, what is the hydration? And then we can talk about Adam, your question, like, how much starter do you put into the bread when you're time to bake?
Yeah. So, I mean, is it a pinch of starter or like what? Give me some example of ratios of flour to water to starter.
Well, that brings up what's known as baking percentages. So people say like, well, do you have a recipe for bread? It's like, well, there's not really a recipe, but there's percentages. So there's right. proportions that you follow. So when I do a round of baking, I usually start with 1,000 grams. A flour bakers usually use grams. And that makes it really easy to do percentages. So everything, all baker's percentages, it refers to like a percentage of the flour amount. So with 1,000 grams of flour with a kilo, you maybe do 800 grams of water, and that would mean 800 over 1,000, you have 80% hydration.
Okay.
And so everything is then and like then, measured out as a proportion of the bread,
of
the flour.
So that makes sense. And then what? Then where does the starter factor into that?
So it really can vary. Some bakers use as much as like 33% starter, so 330 grams, wow. a third of the weight of the flour.
And then does that make the bread tangier and funkier, et cetera?
Yeah, it'll make it ferment a lot faster. Uh-huh. So you have more of the yeast and bacteria, so it'll be a more active dough. It won't take quite as long at room temperature to ferment. But I use around 20%. So for 1,000 grams of flour, about 200 grams of starter. I don't know, Andy, how does that compare?
I'm usually doing one at a time. So I'm doing half. So I'm doing 500 grams of flour right now. And I've been changing it for the last 3 years. Right now I'm doing about 321 grams of water.
Oh, yeah. Got to be 21.
And
yeah.
about 100 grams of starter. And that's,
so that would be the equivalent of 200 to your, which is what
yeah.
you said, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I take a tablespoon of starter from the fridge, put it in a bowl with 50 grams of water, room temperature.
But wait, so just the only difference, so the difference between yours and his, he has less hydration. Because he said if he was doing 1,000, he would be at 642. Right. You said you do 800.
Yeah. So I usually go around 80%.
Right.
But yeah, so you're about 64%.
Yeah. But, you know, in the wintertime when the apartments are drier and there's not as much humidity in the air, I tend to increase the hydration just to make up for it.
And what kind of—
I'm sorry, just because I'm very curious. Are you doing this— do you do that sort of intuitively by feel and look, or are you like measuring it out? You know?
I used to think I could do it by measuring out, and then, you know— inevitably, you'd say, what happened? You know, it worked a week ago. Why didn't it work today? So, and it's probably, you know, they always say that, you know, the difference between baking and cooking is that there's science involved in baking. And, you know, you can't really improvise that much. You know, that's why, as Claire was saying, you know, using grams as a measurement, it's a lot more specific than ounces, for instance, you know, a 20th of an ounce. You know, with grams, it's 1-2. So, you know, when I was... I was sticking to my rule of, you know, this amount of that, of flour, this amount of water. And something didn't work, so I'd kind of alter it the next time. And I got into the really probably the bad baker's habit of improvising with my dough. And using my hands to feel, like, that feels like a really wet dough for some reason.
Isn't that a good idea, Claire, that you shouldn't it be by feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're, if you're baking every day with the same flour and the same starter, you probably develop that intuition pretty quickly of like, oh, it just feels different today based on the weather or the temperature.
Yeah, might need a little more flour.
Yeah, but if you're changing it up a lot, it's like I always measure, but that's just my sort of
you're precise.
My insecurity. Yeah, yeah. And so, but just to answer, Adam, to answer your question earlier, you change the amount of water also based on the flour that you're using. So are you using all white flour?
I'm using, all bread flour, which is, I think, a little more higher protein than all-purpose flour, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. And so I always throw in a little bit of whole wheat flour. And so whole wheat flour is, when you get white flour, like white bread flour, it's just the endosperm.
You say, we'll get to endosperm in a second. When you say a little bit, so what does that mean? Like, what's the ratio?
Right. Okay, so I use 1,000 grams of flour total, but I'm using 800 grams of white bread flour, 150 grams of whole wheat bread flour, and then I like to throw in just 50 grams of some other, like, alternative wheat flour, like spelt or rye, because I like the flavor.
What would happen if you used all wheat flour and no white at all?
You would get, typically when you use all white flour, you get a much more open crumb, which is sort of like a baker's speak for like bigger holes and like more irregular holes. When you add, and so you get also more gluten. It's like the other.
So is white flour typically more glutinous? Like pasta, like pizza dough, white pizza dough. You ever have whole wheat pizza dough? It's not the same.
Right. You get something a little denser, a little tougher, like not as springy. But so one reason, so you might be thinking like, well, then why would you add any whole wheat or anything? But when whole wheat interacts with the starter, all that yeast and bacteria, like, they love, it loves whole wheat, and it creates all these cool, like, funky flavors as the dough ferments. So you have to sort of strike this balance between flavor and texture, I think, with adding whole wheat flours. So I find that if you go, if you have, like, 80% of your flour is white flour, you get all the texture and, like, whole structure and springiness, but then you also get, with the remaining flour, this great flavor development.
Have you considered this, Andy?
Yeah, and I have used whole wheat flour. And I've tried, I think, for the wifey project.
Which is my wife and her good friend Janine's sort of art gallery slash cafe space in Brooklyn, where Andy was doing doing a bread program for a while.
Well, yeah, yeah. I was.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, it's a challenge when, you know, someone is depending on a professional baker using professional equipment and space, and then switches quickly, you know, while in stride to a home baker. I couldn't really provide 10 loaves a day at 7 in the morning. But they asked if I could do some whole wheat. So I did. And I was doing, I think for 500 grams, I was doing about 400 grams bread and 100 grams. And it gives it obviously a slightly darker color.
How did you personally like that bread compared to your go-to?
I didn't mind it. But
ringing endorsement.
No. It does add some more flavor. It was tangier, you know, probably fermenting different. So it was a little bit more conventionally sour. And I don't, you know, this is technically a sourdough, but I don't like sourdough bread, which is strange. So, and by
Claire,
that—
Claire just looked at you side-eyed.
Yeah, no, by
but
that—
But this must run in the family, because Adam, you famously, you don't like sourdough either.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to just interject for a while. So I went to school in the Bay Area. Go Bears. Cal Bears. The problem I have with San Francisco is that everything is sourdough. And it's like you go and you get a baguette and the baguette is sourdough. It's like, no one wants a sourdough baguette. You don't go to Paris and like, they're not supposed to be sourdough. And it's just such an overweeningly sourdough city that it's just like, it's just everything is tangy. And like, I'm sick of the tang. So it's like— okay. I like sourdough if Chad Robertson's making it or something, but I just don't want sourdough all the time, and especially mediocre sourdough. There's nothing lamer when like you get a turkey sandwich, and I'm like, I don't want your mediocre sourdough bread with my turkey sandwich and mayo. Just give me some good white bread or good wheat bread. Can I just get some wheat bread that's not sourdough?
So you had it forced on you. I get it. But also, I just want to say, it's interesting about San Francisco, because you hear that like San Francisco sourdough is a thing, and that's because, Andy, to your point earlier, like depending on where you are, the whole, like, the colonies of yeast and bacteria in different parts of the country, different parts of the world are different. So, like, San Francisco sourdough can only be made in San Francisco because, like, they have, it's like this wind's coming off the bay. It's like a whole thing. So, like, I don't know. Maybe you just don't like San Francisco. I don't know. Never mind.
I have a lot of issues with San Francisco, but we'll get to those. Anna, how would you bring the bread over here? Let's get into this bread. First of all, let's cut open.
You want to
cut it? Yeah. So maybe pull the cutting board. So my question is this. You were also talking about, you know, no two loaves are the same. You never quite master it. Can you tell before you cut into the loaf, just picking it up, how good this loaf is going to be or not good based on its weight and how hard it is on the outside, that sort of stuff?
Well, good. I mean, okay. So there's good tasting. And there's good looking.
Yep.
And one does not necessarily beget the other.
And good texture and stuff. Good,
well, yeah, and it's a nice crumb, you know, meaning the size of the holes, the variety of holes. And I've made breads that have great looking crumbs, but just tasted kind of, there wasn't much going on.
Let's go do that. Wow.
That's a good sound.
A little dense.
So what does that tell you?
I want to feel it. See, can I do that thing where you touch your nose to the bread? Is that a thing?
Sure.
No, seriously, is that a thing that you do to see how wet the bread is?
I think, they not just smelling it?
I thought you like literally touch like the tip of your nose to feel if it's like nice and wet. Do bakers not do that?
I've never heard of that.
I thought that was a thing.
Could be. No idea.
Apparently that's not a thing.
Is that a European thing?
It's like when chefs touch the fish tester to their bottom lip or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, but because it should be kind of like a really good bread if you're talking, whether it's here in New York, whether it's She Wolf or Bien Cui or obviously Chad out in San Francisco, the really good stuff is there's a wetness almost to it. Even though the outside is hard and like the solidity to it, the inside is right. moist.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Oh, we had butter over here. And jam.
I already started eating it.
So, Claire, what's your initial thoughts?
I think it tastes great. One thing I was about to point out earlier was that you see on the outside of the loaf these little tiny bubbles. Like, you see it on good homemade bagels, like these tiny little pockets of air. I think that's a sign of a well-fermented, like a properly fermented loaf, is you get all these little, like, crunchy pockets on the outside, too. It's a little sour. It's not overpowering.
There's a little tang. I would say more of a tang. I mean, it's all semantics, but tang rather than a sourness.
All right, so I have a question. A lot of questions. Would you like some jam, Claire? We got some.
I'm eating it plain.
Jam.
Just so I can really taste the bread.
So how do you make a bread like a proper Parisian baguette if you're not using a starter? If there is no sourdough in it, then how do you get those active, elements in there?
So
baguettes are impossible.
I've never tried. I've made baguettes once, and it was like during our baking unit in culinary school. I did go to culinary school in France, so I feel like I'm trying to remember what that dude told us in French about how to make baguettes. But baguettes are traditionally they're not naturally leavened. They're leavened with like commercial yeast. Mm-hmm. So like a baker's yeast, which comes in like little like compacted cubes that you break up and then add to the dough. So baguettes are made very quickly. Like you add the yeast to the dough. You let it rise, you form them, and you bake them. It's not a long rise. And so it's made – baguettes, like, in the grand scheme of bread baking are not that old. Like, it's something that really could only be developed with the advent of commercial yeast and, big bakeries. So it's very neutral in flavor. Like, it's really – you kind of really just taste like white flour. And they're delicious, and you have all that crust on the outside. But it's not a sourdough. You can find – baguette de campagne, where it's like a more country style, or a l'ancienne, like an older style one.
Those are kind of like the ones, I want to say, that the bakery Bianqui here in New York makes, where the crust is a harder, crunchier crust, and there is a little bit of tang to it, as opposed to that very flaky, just pure white bread sort of Parisian style.
I tried to make, speaking of Chad, I tried to make Chad Robertson's baguette recipe in his book. He uses dry yeast, and he makes a pouliche. Uh-huh. With a starter. So it's using two different kinds of yeast, basically. It was so complicated.
I had to read that
section three times in a row, attempted it, got lost while making it. Like, where am I? What hour is it? When do I do that? It was a disaster. But from the pictures in the book, he proved it can work. But then again, he's like this wizard, so I have no idea.
Yeah.
So, all right. The next question, this is delicious, by the way.
Well, thanks.
And I bet that this is that sort of, is this at peak eatingness right now, like a few hours out of the oven?
You know, it's like they say with steaks, you know, you have to let it rest because then all the juices will come out. With bread, I always try to let it rest, but the temptation, if you're in your apartment and it smells amazing like bread and there's a hot steaming loaf there, you're going to cut into it. But also, butter-wise, something about putting butter on a bread that will melt the butter because of the temperature, the internal temperature of the bread, is kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to duplicate, with a cool bread.
Yeah, you can revive it. You can put the whole – so what happens when you let the bread cool is, like, all that steam that's trapped inside needs to make its way out. So it comes out of the oven with this really hard crust. And then as it cools, I found that the crust kind of softens as the steam is escaping. And then it, like, reforms again. So there's, like, optimal times to cut it. But especially if you've left the loaf whole, and so like the crust is protecting that crumb on the inside, you can put it back in a hot oven, and it like brings that crust back, and you get like that sound with the knife going through. You can bring that back.
Right.
So the obvious question, Andy, is what the hell do you do with all this bread that you baked?
Give it away.
Literally.
Yeah, I have to. If you see my Instagram page, I usually hashtag giveaway bread. And it was kind of if I was in a business, a marketing ploy where, I literally will say, this bread is for giving away. I mean, if you write me and say, can I have it, I'll give it to you.
But you got to show up and get it.
Yeah, you got to show up and get it. I will travel every once in a while if it's, you know, somebody that I like or know or, you know, works at a restaurant nearby or something like that. Because the, you know, doing the calculations of how many calories, five or 600 grams of flour. And there's been days where I've gone through, you know, half a loaf of bread by myself in a day. Like, what am I thinking? You know, I don't want to go running, but now I have to, you know, like 4 days in a row. And then the other thing is that, you know, I make, if I have one, haven't given it away, I'll make croutons out of it. It makes great croutons. I'll freeze it, slice it before you freeze it, because otherwise.
Well, let's talk about that. So this boule, can I call it a boule?
Sure.
It is about what, 10 inches in diameter? 10, 12?
Maybe 9.
Yeah.
9, 10. We'll call it 9 or 10. Can you talk about the lifespan of a loaf like this in terms of eating, storing? Like, what are your options?
For store, I've discovered that, for instance—
Because if you're not like Andy, you're not going to eat an entire half loaf in one day.
I'm holding a bread that has about two-thirds. I mean, it's got about maybe a half left. If I take this, put the cut side down on a piece of plastic wrap, that will prevent this from getting stale. Mm-hmm. And the crust will maintain its hardness from the air. The air will, and I've had them last for 2 or 3 days easily.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Naturally fermented breads tend to last a really long time.
Because mm-hmm. if you put it in a bag, then that crust starts to lose its crackliness,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you can bring the crust back. I find that storing in like a paper bag is really good. Not something like a Ziploc. Yeah. It's like it traps too much of the moisture.
Right? It does,
and it gets a little weird. But it responds really, really well to toasting. So, I mean, I've toasted bread like
exactly
4 or 5 days after I've made it.
Well, at what point, when do you go from the fresh to toasted sort of moment? What's a tipping point?
I mean, probably day two, just because I want that crust
morning.
Again.
Yeah.
But it still tastes great, and it's still, especially with the higher hydration breads, they retain so much moisture. They're not dry and like stale the way that other bread stales.
That's the other thing that I noticed with whole wheat bread. For me, maybe you can defer, but toasting whole wheat bread doesn't work for me. It loses something. It creates this almost new flavor, kind of a weird pungent something. And white bread for me toasts up better. So
yeah, I found that with whole wheat, I bake my. We should also talk about how you bake them, because there's a method where you bake them in a Dutch oven. I found that when I bake.
Oh yeah, we haven't talked about that.
Yeah, I find when you bake loaves with whole wheat, I tend to take them really, really dark, like some people might call them burnt. I would say they're bien cuit, as they say, right. well done or well cooked. And you get like some slight bitterness, almost like molassesy notes in the crust with whole wheat that I think some people are like, they're just looking for a plain loaf with bread, you know, with butter and jam. It's maybe not ideal.
Sure. You know, it's really good at the, is that High Street on Hudson? And they do the Annadama bread,
mm-hmm.
correct? With like that's got the corn and molasses on the inside, and that loaf, the crust gets super dark and almost that burnt taste, but plays off that wet sweetness on the inside really nicely.
Yeah, and if you've ever had a loaf of like She-Wolf, a lot of bakeries make a version of like a Scandinavian rye bread that comes in super dense. It comes in the loaf with all these sprouted grains. Same thing, like you know. The bread, it's so dark on the outside, and it has all these really like interesting but slightly bitter notes. I found that with whole wheat, you get that a lot more. Also, I don't want to interrupt the conversation, but I have to,
ooh.
My bread is fermenting. I have my dough next to me, and I have to do what's called a series of turns
to
strengthen it.
This.
So I'm going to put my headphones down and do this.
I'm going to narrate.
I have to stand up and do it. Hold on.
I'm going to narrate. So Clara's standing up. She's got like a plastic bin that's probably like 14 inches by 12 inches or 16 by 12. And there's this gooey blob at the bottom that your kids like might play with if they're like in fourth grade. You're picking the whole thing up and stretching it, and it's sticky and kind of wet, and you're just kind of flopping it around.
Here, can you hear me do this? So this step, so the dough is fermenting. It's at room temperature. It's been going for about an hour. And this process of picking the dough up and stretching it and let it kind of fall back on itself is it helps strengthen the dough. So I'm like reforming these gluten chains. It's all very technical, but it's also really fun. I love like the tactile feeling of it. It's this weird texture where it's like kind of solid and kind of liquid.
It's wobbly.
In between state. And I can see that there's little areas where it's bubbling up. So that's good. That means there's activity.
Well, it's like that Like, you know, when you're a little kid and you're playing with slime or whatever, I mean, it's usually green. This is kind of a beigey color, but yeah. Oh, so Andy, let's talk about, while Claire's doing that.
That's such a satisfying motion.
Yeah. What, so just for the home listener, you guys, so when you're making this bread at home, you've got your starter, you're taking your 1,000 or 500 grams of flour and the water and mixing it together. You've got the dough, it's going through this process where it's sort of getting ready. And then you take the dough, you got your little basket, and you turn it out into like a Dutch oven. Like that's what you're actually baking it in?
I use it's a round 4.5 quart Creuset. Mm-hmm. I have two of them. The temperature of my oven goes up to 500. So I started at 500. And when it reaches that, I turn it down to 450.
Okay.
Pop the dough in.
How high? Lower rack? Upper
middle
rack.
Middle rack. Yeah. Put the dough in, slash it as I feel. If I'm feeling artistic that day or just want to get it over with, do a square or an X or something like that. Put the top on. I do 20 minutes top on.
Uh-huh.
Take the top off. And do an additional 25 or so minutes.
How do you decide when it's done?
Well, you trust that the recipe is going to work every time. It's funny because this, if you don't, I sometimes will flour the top of the dough quite a lot, and it's hard to see how brown it gets, obviously, because the flour maintains kind of a beigey kind of color. But with this one, which you can't see, you can see where the flour is not, you know, on the dough, how dark it got. And I think that's probably pretty good for a white bread.
Real good.
Like, you know.
Claire, what's the difference between a basic home gas oven and a professional baking oven?
Yeah. So big bakeries that are doing high production will have what's called multi-deck steam ovens. So these are ovens where there's a steam injection function. So steam is very important for baking bread. I actually, when I was researching the bread recipe, talked to a bunch of bakers to sort of get like, there's all these sort of, there's like common knowledge about bread. And I think people know, oh, you need steam when you bake bread, but it's not really clear why. So what happens is you need high heat too. So Andy said 500. That's as high as our ovens go in the test kitchen. And that's what I use too. If it went higher, I would go higher. The idea is that you're putting the bread in a super hot oven and the gas inside is rapidly expanding as it heats up and it's raising the bread. So,
but I assume they are not putting their bread in Creuset Dutch ovens.
No. So the reason they need steam is because steam keeps the outside of the bread, the starches on the outside of the bread, pliable so that the bread can sort of reach what's called maximum oven spring. Oven spring is like how much your bread grows when you're baking. And if you don't have that, the outside will start to like set and seize up before it's really been able to expand, before all the gas has been able to expand. And then you get like really wonky looking, like weird loaves. So some like professional ovens have a steam injection function where it's like plumbed in and it's, you know, putting steam in. But obviously a home oven doesn't have that. So there's a lot of ways that home bakers have come up with like a workaround for that. And one way is to bake in a Dutch oven. So that's what I do also. It's a pretty popular method. That's the method we use in our bread recipe. And basically you're creating this sealed environment where the bread is like self-steaming. So you put the lid on. I think another important thing is that you preheat the Dutch oven in, you know, put the Dutch oven in, then turn on your oven. I let it go for like at least 30 minutes. So I'm sure it's super, super hot because you want that dough to start. You want the gas to start expanding as soon as it goes in the oven. And so you put it in with the lid on for the first, I go like 15 or 20 minutes, Andy, just what you do. And during that time, the bread has a ton of moisture in it and it's creating its own steam. And once it's achieved like maximum oven spring, which happens at about 15 or 20 minutes, then you take the lid off and that's when it takes on all of its color. So the Dutch oven is just a lot of people have one at home. Like enameled is fine. If you have just straight cast iron, that works great too. With the Le Creuset, you have to be careful because some of the knobs are not heat safe after like 400 or 425. So I just unscrew the knob and plug it the hole with like a little piece of foil. But it works really, really well.
Well, guys, it's been
They get hot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Andy's got the scars to prove it. Yeah, when you said you got to heat it up first and then put the dough in, I'm like, that's got to hurt.
Oh, my God. I've never had my heartbeat so fast as the first time I dropped a huge blob of dough into a 500-degree Dutch oven.
It's insane.
Every time.
Okay, so if you want to check out Claire's home-baked bread recipe without a starter, it's called BA's Best Bread on bonappetit.com. If you really want to get into home bread baking, do you go out and buy Chad's Tartine Bakery cookbook? Is that the one to get?
I'd say yeah. I mean, you know.
Any other books, Claire, that you recommend?
I will say the pictures will be intimidating because I guarantee there's no way that your first try is going to look anything like what he does.
Yeah, don't be discouraged. Bien Cui, the baker, Zach, I can't remember his last name. That book came out about a year ago.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's like a super intensive but very thorough like sort of sourdough primer. There's a lot of them out there.
Peter Reinhardt's books. Yeah.
Peter Reinhardt is like sort of, you know, a master bread baker. King Arthur Flour website, I find, is also a really good resource for information. There's like all these other weird deep bread forums.
The great thing is that if you have a question and you type a vague version of the question to Google, that forum will pop up, and it's a rabbit hole. You will go down that rabbit hole. You could stay there for hours.
Yeah.
Everybody has the same questions you have, I promise.
Okay, so if you want to check out Andy's bread, you can dial him up on Instagram at Andy Rapoport, RAPOPORT 66, and you can see a lot of pictures of bread and bass guitars and various
cheetahbread.com.
Oh, cheetahbread.com. He has branded his bread, cheetahbread.com. And if you want to check out Claire, you can see her all over the Bon Appetit videos on bonappetit.com and our YouTube channel, Bon Appetit YouTube channel.
What?
Baking sorts of things, from sticky buns to what else? What is it? Oh, you did the Twinkie. That was a crazy one.
Oh, yeah. Stay tuned for more of that series.
Yeah, that was
take that soon.
Please.
But guys, it's awesome. And Andy, thanks for the bread.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.